All right, so make sure that you're in 1 Kings chapter 9, and there should be outlines there for you. This morning, I want us to talk about security. Security. Now, we use that word in a lot of different contexts, right? A lot of you probably have security systems maybe on your house or at least on your car when you lock it when you walk into the mall or something like that. We hire security officers, right? There's a whole branch of investments that are labeled securities. And, you know, apparently no one else likes doing announcements like I do. And so I have job security, is what they say. So we use that in a lot of different ways, right? But the idea is that it's either something that keeps you safe or something that is safe, something that's going to be there when you need it, something that's not going to go away. When we think about security, a lot of us, all of us, desire that we would have a secure future. We want to know that going down the road, things aren't going to change out of our control. We want to understand where we're headed and so on. The reality is that's not always promised to us, is it? Our lives are very unpredictable and out of control, and some of that's because we are sinners in our own right, and some of it's because of the world we live in. But we desire a secure future. In our passage in 1 Kings chapter 9, we're going to talk specifically about that, how we can have a secure future, and that's going to bring up our theme for the morning, which is we can have a secure future if we obey God. Obedience to God is the only path to a truly secure future. Obedience to God is the only path to a truly secure future. Now, you remember where we're at in 1 Kings. We've seen the rise of Solomon to the throne. He established his kingdom by putting away the other families and the competitors to the throne. In 1 Kings 3, God asked him what he wanted, and he asked for wisdom that pleased God. And so God promised to give him not only wisdom to rule the kingdom, but also all the things he didn't ask for, riches and wealth and so on. And so Solomon's kingdom has grown over the last several chapters, peaking in 1 Kings 8 when Solomon dedicates the temple to the Lord and they worship and they celebrate the festival, right? That everything was going absolutely right. Well, in your life, when everything is going absolutely right, what is the one thing that you want? To keep it that way, right? Everything is going perfect, and usually at that point, we are tempted to do almost anything to maintain what's going on. Interestingly, God offers to Solomon that exactly. But then we're going to see a very interesting take on what Solomon does after God's offer of security. So, there's two sections to this chapter. The first nine verses we're going to call God's offer of security. God's offer of a secure future to Solomon. And we'll notice the first five verses, God offers a secure future for the obedient. A secure future for the obedient. Let's go ahead and read the first five verses here. 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 1. Now it came about, when Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house and all that Solomon desired to do, that the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. The Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your supplication which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house which you have built by putting my name there forever, and my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. As for you, if you will walk before me as your father David walked, in integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded you, and will keep my statutes and my ordinances, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, just as I promised to your father David, saying, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. God offers to Solomon a very clear, secure future on the condition that Solomon is obedient. Look at verse 1. It says, it came about when Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house and all that Solomon desired to do. And so the building the temple took 7 years. Building the palace complex took 13 years. So this actually occurs in the midpoint of Solomon's reign, maybe give or take a couple of years after that for starting those projects. So we are somewhere in the middle of Solomon's reign, and you'll notice that God is going to talk specifically about Solomon's temple dedication, which matches perfectly the end of chapter 8. You're like, oh, it's right there, two verses away. This is actually over a decade distant from when they actually dedicated the temple, and now here God appears to Solomon and says, I've heard your prayer. Just a reminder that God doesn't always work on our timetables, right? That's okay. But it says that Solomon finished building the house of the Lord, finished building the king's house, and then it says all that Solomon desired to do, all that was inclined in Solomon, all that he delighted in. It's going to come up again later in the chapter. I think that's going to be a key for understanding what Solomon's thinking here. Verse 2, it says that after those things, so we're halfway through Solomon's reign, the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time. Now, if it says a second time, that implies that there was a first time, and we remember that because we're very good students, and that was in 1 Kings chapter 3 a little over a month ago, right? 1 Kings chapter 3, we read in 1 Kings 3, 5, that in Gibeon the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night, and God said, ask what you wish me to give you. So, here in verse 2 of chapter 9, it says the same thing again, that the Lord was seen by Solomon, presumably in a dream again, and they have this dialogue. Specifically, God doing most of the talking, right? The Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your supplication, which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house which you have built by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. What a gracious and kind thing for the Lord to say to Solomon. He has heard. He heard Solomon's prayer. He heard his supplication when Solomon was seeking favor and grace from God on what they had done. And the Lord said, I've heard. I have listened. He says, I've listened to your prayer and supplication which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house which you have built by putting my name there forever. I have set apart the temple that you have built for me to a special service for worshiping me, the one true God. And he says, I've put my name there forever. When you buy a new house, right, and your wife gets the initial of your last name and puts it on the door, right? This is the Scarborough's house, whatever. God has put his name on Solomon's temple. This is the place that I will be worshiped. This is my quote-unquote home address, if you will. My eyes, my heart will be there perpetually. Really quick, flip over to 2 Chronicles chapter 7. This is a little bit of an aside, but I want to point out something because there's a very famous verse that comes in the context of this conversation, this address that God is giving Solomon, and I want to point out why we need to be careful how we understand that verse. So notice in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, starting in verse 12, you're going to notice this is the same context as we just read in 1 Kings 9. Thus Solomon, verse 11, Solomon finished the house of the Lord in the king's palace. Verse 12, the Lord appeared to Solomon at night and said to him, I have heard your prayer and have chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice. Now, verses 13 and 14 don't appear in 1 Kings 9. They just appear here in Chronicles, okay? But look at what they say. God says, if I shut up the heavens so that there is no rain, or if I command the locusts to devour the land, or if I send pestilence among my people, and my people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven, will forgive their sin, and will heal their land. Now, I'm sure you all, like me, have seen that verse printed on something at, Mardell or Hobby Lobby or something like that. I just wanted to point out that the context of that verse is very specific. It is a promise to Solomon and the nation of Israel in the Old Testament. It's in response to Solomon dedicating the temple to the worship of God. And you'll notice that the people who are called by my name humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, that's in response to God disciplining them for their sin. And so while there are definitely applications to that to our lives and to our country, frankly, we need to be careful not to take this promise one-for-one equivalency, okay? Then it goes on in verse 15 in Chronicles, now my eyes will be open and my ears attentive to the prayer offered in this place. You see how he says his eyes and his heart will be there perpetually? What does that mean? It means his eyes will be open and my ears attentive to the prayer offered in this place. God listens when we humbly worship him as he has prescribed. If we do it the way he says, he listens and he hears us. So turn back to 1 Kings chapter 9. Keep moving through. He says, My eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. Literally says, all days. Every day, all the time, from now on, my eyes and my heart will be on the people who are worshiping me in humility and truth. And we know that from the rest of Scripture. Psalm 10, 17, O Lord, you have heard the desire of the humble. You will strengthen their heart and you will incline your ear. Or my favorite one we read last week, Psalm 34, 17, the righteous cry and the Lord hears. Remember that we must pray. The Lord listens. He hears the cries of his people. He won't abandon us. Verse 4 goes on. God says, as for you, transitions from speaking about the temple and the people in general to speaking specifically to Solomon. As for you, if you will walk before me as your father David walked. Psalm 128:1 says, how blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. That's the call. That is the standard for a follower of God, is that we walk in the path that God has set before us. He has clearly instructed us, and therefore we are to walk in his ways. And Psalm 128 says, that's a good thing. How blessed is that one who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. God calls Solomon, if you will walk before me as your father David walked. Well, how did David walk? Well, he walked in integrity and uprightness of heart, like God tells Solomon here. Remember back in chapter 3, verse 6, when God asks Solomon what he would like, Solomon responds in great humility, and he says to God, 1 Kings 3, 6, you have shown great loving kindness to your servant David, my father, according as he walked before you in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart. Solomon knew when God said, you need to walk like your father David walked, Solomon knew what that meant. It wasn't that, oh, I need to conquer this whole land, I need to do all these things. No, it was, you need to walk before me in uprightness of heart. And you'll notice, remember at the end of chapter 3, verse 14, God made a conditional promise to Solomon there. When he asked for wisdom, he said, I will promise you all these things. And then he says, if you walk in my ways, as your father David walked, I will prolong your days. I will give you a long life if you will walk in the same way your father David walked. And here in chapter 9, verse 4, God has another conditional offer for Solomon. If you walk before me as your father David walked, his promise from chapter 3 still applies. I'll give you a long life. And then here we go to verse 5, and we'll notice that God promises to establish his kingdom, establish his throne. If you will walk according to your father David walked in integrity and uprightness of heart. Integrity has the idea of being straight or right. Uprightness of heart is being honest, having a clear conscience before the Lord. And then here he says, I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever. I want us to remember, we talked about last week, God always keeps his promises. That doesn't mean that God doesn't put conditions on his promises, right? And we see even here, if you will walk before me in my ways as your father David walked, I will prolong your life, I will establish your throne. But if we keep the condition that God sets down, God will always keep his end of the bargain. You understand? He says, I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, just as I promised to your father David, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. God's promises cannot be broken. He says, you will have this throne. And he says, you will not lack a man on the throne. The line will not be cut off, it says. God makes a very sincere, honest, secure offer to Solomon. But it has a condition. Solomon must live his life in obedience to what God has said, just like David did. So the question for you and for me is, where do we need to grow in walking in the ways of God? What are the ways that our lives are not matching up with what God has put down in his word for our lives? Where do we need to grow in that integrity and uprightness of heart? What is something that weighs on our conscience because we haven't repented and confessed it to the Lord? The other question is, do we even know what God has commanded us? Do we know what God's ways are that we're supposed to walk in? Well, how are we going to find out? We need to study the scripture, study what God has instructed us to do so that we can know exactly what God's ways are so that we can walk in them in our lives. God makes an offer to Solomon, a secure future for the obedient, but then he gives him a warning. There is certain failure for the disobedient. Certain failure for the disobedient. Verses 6 through 9, but if you or your sons indeed turn away from following me and do not keep my commandments and my statutes, which I have set before you, and go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them and the house which I have consecrated for my name, I will cast out of my sight. So Israel will become a proverb and a byword among the peoples. And this house will become a house of ruins. Everyone who passed by will be astonished and hiss and say, why has the Lord done this to the land and to this house? And they will say, because they forsook the Lord their God who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt, and they adopted other gods and worshiped them and served them. Therefore, the Lord has brought all this adversity on them. As sure as God's promise to establish Solomon's throne if he obeys is as sure as his warning that if Solomon disobeys, he will lose everything. You see that? Verse 6, if you or your sons indeed turn away, it's a doubled verb, it's intensive. If you run away from me, if you abandon me, like Saul, 1 Samuel 15, Saul, he turned his back from following me. If you or your sons turn away from following me, and do not obey the instructions that I have set before you, I've given you very clearly, then this will be the result. You know, back in the Torah, the first five books, this was a very clear understanding with the people of Israel that there was this balance. Obedience to God brought blessing. Rebellion against God brought curses. We see that in Leviticus chapter 26, Deuteronomy 28 very clearly. Deuteronomy 28:15, it shall come about, if you do not obey the Lord your God to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes, with which I charge you today, all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. God isn't changing the rules here, okay? This is the way that he has dealt with his people the whole time, and he is reminding Solomon, this is the way you keep the awesome kingdom that you have right now, is you obey. And if you disobey, this is what will happen. Says, if you or your sons turn away from me, if you adopt other gods, if you go after and serve them, bowing down before them, he said, adopting them, seizing them, taking hold of them. So the question for you and me is, in what ways are we tempted to turn away from God, to not serve him with uprightness of heart, full, wholeheartedly? In what ways are we tempted to turn to our own devices, to our own pleasure? A warning that we will lose what God has blessed us with if we continue in our sin. 1 Kings 9, verse 7, he says, if you do this, if you turn away from me, I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them, and the house which I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight. Israel will become a proverb and a byword among the peoples. I will cut them off from the land. God prophesies the exile here. If they disobeyed, they would be sent away from the promised land that they had been given. And notice there's kind of three promises that God makes here, three warnings, and Dale Ralph Davis sums them up. He says, infidelity will bring the loss of turf, temple, and throne. He says, I will cut them off from the land, cut them off from the sanctuary, and cut off the kingship of Solomon. And he finishes his comments and he says, only a fool would flirt with faithlessness. Solomon is about to lose everything if he walks and turns away from God. But you'll notice, I want to be clear here, that in verse 6, God says specifically, if you or your sons turn away from following me. Who's he talking about? He's talking about Solomon and the kings that would follow him, right? But you'll notice in verse 7, who's bearing the consequences of this? It's the whole nation. Sin never affects just you. Sin has consequences, and those consequences are far-reaching. The expositor's commentary says, as the king goes, so goes the people. If you are in a position of leadership, which all of you are in some way, shape, or form, whether you are a husband and father over your family, whether you have some position at work, whether you are just have more life experience than someone that you meet on the street, your influence on other people matters because your sin and the influence you exude through your life could have consequences on the people around you. We need to be careful. If Solomon himself turned away from worshiping God wholly, then the whole nation would bear the consequences of his sin. Verse 8, God describes what he will do. He says, this house will become a heap of ruins, such that everyone who passes by will be astonished and hiss and say, why has the Lord done this? The hiss is not like what we think of like a snake doing, okay? It actually might mean more of a whistle, something like that. But I think in our society, it's kind of that disgusted huff, right? It's that you walk by and you see something disgusting, right? That's the idea. People from other nations are going to see what God has done to the temple and to the nation, and they're going to say, huh, what happened? What did they do to their God to bring about this? And you'll notice that they'll know. They will know exactly what happened. God's reputation is not on the line here. God is perfectly faithful. Someone will say to them, because, why did all this happen? Why did this judgment come? It's because they forsook their Lord. Because they forsook the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt, and they adopted other gods and worshiped them and served them. Therefore, the Lord has brought all this adversity on them. God is not the one making bad choices here. The people did, they sinned, and therefore, God has brought this judgment on them. They will be a proverb and a byword. Deuteronomy 28:37 says, you'll become a horror and a proverb and a taunt. Turn over real quick. We're going to do one more of these dives into another passage. Deuteronomy chapter 29. Kind of the same thing as 2 Chronicles. There's a famous verse in Deuteronomy 29 that I also think is often misunderstood. And I want us to be clear on the context there as well. Deuteronomy 29, let's look at verse 24. A very similar statement that God makes to Solomon, he made years before in Deuteronomy. Verse 24, all the nations will say, why has the Lord done this to the land? Why this great outburst of anger? Then men will say, because they forsook the covenant of the Lord, the God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. When God disciplines his people, everyone else is going to know why. And so he goes on, verse 26, they went and served other gods and worshiped them, gods whom they have not known and whom they had not allotted to them. Therefore the anger of the Lord burned against that land to bring upon it every curse which is written in this book. And the Lord uprooted them from their land in anger and in fury and in great wrath and cast them into another land as it is to this day. Now we come to this famous verse you've probably heard, verse 29. The secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things revealed belong to us and to our sons forever, that we may observe all the words of this law. Now, normally when we hear that verse, we focus on the first part. The secret things belong to the Lord, and we should. We need to be careful not to try and find out the things that we're not supposed to find out. God knows more than you. He's always going to know more than you. And therefore, the things that he has not revealed to you are none of your business, okay? But what we fail to do is look at the second half of the verse, which is the point here. The second half says, the things revealed belong to us and to our sons forever, that we may observe all the words of this law. What's his point? The things that God expects from you and the punishment for not doing those things are clearly articulated in the scripture. He said, all the curses written in this book will come upon you if you disobey. Then he gets to verse 29. There are some things that only the Lord knows, but the things revealed You need to know why, so that you may observe all the words of this law. We are not, being ignorant of the scripture is no excuse for our sin. Do you understand? God has given us what we need to do, and therefore we need to obey. And if not, then God's just punishment comes on our sin. So, back in 1 Kings, sorry, that was my second soapbox of the day. I think I'm done. We'll see, all right? Back in 1 Kings chapter 9. Again, just a reminder, God's instructions to Solomon have been overly clear. Matthew Henry said it this way, God deals plainly with us and sets before us good and evil, the blessing and the curse, and lets us know what we must trust to. God has dealt plainly with us. I know you guys have all had a time, maybe you had a boss who expected something, but they didn't clearly articulate their instructions. You didn't really know what you were supposed to be doing, and you felt frustrated. That's not how it is with God. God deals plainly with us. It is up to us to read and understand, to know his will through his word, and to obey it. But if you're noticing here, you're saying, wait a second, God is giving this warning to Solomon, and God has a right to do that, of course, to tell Solomon that if he disobeys, he's going to lose his kingdom. But I thought God promised to David that he wouldn't lose his kingdom. 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 12, when your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your descendant after you who will come forth from you. I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name. I'll establish the throne of his kingdom forever. Verse 16, your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne will be forever established. Wait a second. How can God be faithful to his promise to David and also be faithful to his promise to Solomon to punish him and take away his kingdom if he disobeys? Well, you'll notice that David's kingdom lasts forever. Why? Because we have a perfect David sitting on the throne, right? The Bible Knowledge Commentary says this, the Davidic dynasty, though interrupted for centuries, will be restored by the Messiah when he sits on David's throne in the millennium. Psalm 89, verse 30 and down to verse 37. Listen to this. If his sons forsake my law and do not walk in my judgments, if they violate my statutes and do not keep my commandments, I will punish their transgression with the rod and their iniquity with stripes. Psalm 89, 33. But I will not break off my loving kindness from him, nor deal falsely in my faithfulness. My covenant I will not violate, nor will I alter the utterance of my lips. Listen to this. Once I have sworn by my holiness, I will not lie to David. His descendant shall endure forever, and his throne as the sun before me. It shall be established forever like the moon, and the witness in the sky is faithful. God did not lie to David. His covenant is sure. God always keeps his promises. He's going to keep his promise to Solomon when he disobeys. He's going to take the kingdom away from Solomon. And yet, God in his providence is going to maintain the Davidic line all the way down to the perfect second David, who will sit on the throne when he returns. God always keeps his promises. And when they are conditional, it is wise for us to obey. So, God offers security, a secure future to Solomon. For the second section, for the second half of the chapter, I want us to notice Solomon illustrates for us when we attempt to secure our own futures. Okay? When we attempt to secure our own futures. So the first attempt at security Solomon has in verses 10 to 14 is the security of relationships, we'll say. The security of relationships. Let's read these couple verses, 10 to 14. It came about at the end of 20 years in which Solomon had built the two houses. So around the same time period as God made this statement to Solomon, the house of the Lord and the king's house, Hiram, king of Tyre, had supplied Solomon with cedar and cypress timber and gold according to all his desires. So the point is that Hiram had supplied everything that was needed to build the house for God and the king's house. Then King Solomon gave Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee. So Hiram came out from Tyre to see the cities which Solomon had given him, and they did not please him. He said, "What are these cities which you have given me, my brother?" So they were called the land of Kabul to this day. And Hiram sent to the king 120 talents of gold. So again, it says at the end of 20 years, so shortly after this time when God speaks to Solomon, it says Solomon had finished both of the houses, the king's house and the house of the Lord. And then it says, it comments, why are we talking about Hiram right now? Well, Hiram was the one who supplied all the materials for building those things. And so it says King Solomon, in some ways, kind of as a thank you gift, right? You know, sometimes you make a big purchase and they throw in a bonus or something at the end. Kind of maybe the idea. So King Solomon gave Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee, in the north side. And it says that Hiram, he came out from Tyre to see the cities which Solomon had given him, and they did not please him. It says they weren't smooth to his eyes. Okay, they weren't agreeable. He didn't like them. And so he says, what are these cities which you have given me, my brother? Now, you know, he's not offended to the point where he's going to break off their treaty, but this is not what he was expecting, right? And so it says they were called the land of Kabul to this day. We don't know exactly what that means, but it likely means something like they're worthless, worth nothing, okay? So Solomon, trying to maintain the, you know, kind of this political alliance that he has with Tyre, now that they're construction contracts are done, he wants to maintain that relationship, so he gives this gift to Hiram, and Hiram is not impressed. And yet, Hiram still returns the favor and sends a gift of gold back to Solomon. What's interesting is if you look at the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles 8, it says it the other way. It says that Hiram gave the cities to Solomon, and Solomon settled Israelites there. What's the idea? Well, probably he gave it back. He looked at them and said, I don't actually want this. And most likely they were unconquered at the time. They were still filled with the natives in the land. And so, you know, Hiram says, I'm not interested. This sounds like work to me. You can have these back. And therefore Solomon had to go and fill them with Israelites there. Okay? So a reminder for us, a couple applications. One, are we even honest and generous in our dealings with other people? You know, Solomon kind of re-gifted something that he didn't really need in the first place to try and satisfy King Hiram. Not a good idea. If you wouldn't want the gift yourself, you shouldn't be giving it to someone else and pretending like it's a good gift, okay? But more seriously, we need to be careful that when we are looking for what is going to satisfy us, what is going to make us feel secure in our lives and in our futures, we're not looking to people. Solomon here is trying to maintain these business relationships that he has with the other kingdoms, these alliances, when all he really needs to be doing is what? Obeying the Lord. His second attempt at finding security is the security of accomplishment. Security of accomplishment. Let's read these verses, 15 to 24. This is the account of the forced labor which King Solomon levied to build the house of the Lord, his own house, the Millo, the wall of Jerusalem, Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. For Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and captured Gezer and burned it with fire, killed the Canaanites who lived in the city, and given it as a dowry to his daughter, Solomon's wife. So Solomon rebuilt Gezer and lower Beth Horon and Baalath and Tamar in the wilderness in the land of Judah. And all the storage cities which Solomon had, even the cities for his chariots and the cities for his horsemen, and all that it pleased Solomon to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and all the land under his rule. As for all the people who were left of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, who were not of the sons of Israel, their descendants who were left after them in the land, whom the sons of Israel were unable to destroy utterly, from them Solomon levied forced laborers even to this day. But Solomon did not make slaves of the sons of Israel, for they were men of war, servants, princes, captains, chariot commanders, and horsemen. These were the chief officers who were over Solomon's work, 550, who ruled over the people doing the work. And as soon as Pharaoh's daughter came up from the city of David to her house, which Solomon built for her, then he built the Millo. Okay? There's a lot going on here, but it's pretty self-explanatory. Let's walk through it. So this is the account of all the projects that Solomon has done, and it says it starts with noting that he used forced labor to do it. Back in chapter 5, verse 13, it tells us that he forced laborers numbered 30,000 men, and we know that there was a lot more. That was just one section of them. There were other groups of many tens of thousands of men serving in different ways, and then it goes on to describe what he did with them. Okay, verse 15, it says he built the Millo, the wall of Jerusalem, Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Now, if we look at a map, we're going to notice that's kind of small, but I'm going to point it out to you, okay? So you'll notice You have Jerusalem here, and it says the cities that he fortified, you have Megiddo guarding the north trails. You have Hazor guarding the north trails, Megiddo guarding the Jezreel Valley here, and then you have upper and lower Beth Horon, Gezer, Beth Shemesh, and guarding the west, and then you have Tamar down here in the south guarding any southern approach. So what's the idea? He's establishing and fortifying his kingdom, building military outposts all around Jerusalem where anyone might come to attack. Okay. Now, why Gezer? Well, we just get this comment here in verse 16. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and captured Gezer. So apparently Gezer was not held by Israel at the time. So Pharaoh had come up, he had killed the Canaanites that were living there and just burned the whole thing to the ground. And then as a wedding present to his daughter, Solomon's wife, he gave that land to Solomon, and Solomon rebuilt Gezer. And then it goes on, he rebuilt lower Beth Horon, Baalath, Tamar in the wilderness, and so on. All right. Now, verse 19 says that all the storage cities which Solomon had, the cities for his chariots and horsemen. So either in these cities or more likely others as well, Solomon spread out where there were cities that held large portions of grain and meal and so on and so forth, storage cities for food, and also there were specific, you know, what we call military bases, right? There were military outposts around the country that had chariots, that had horsemen, and so on. And so Solomon is fortifying his kingdom both with food and also with military assets. So we get down to verse the middle of 19, but again, notice this phrase that's used. It says, all the storage cities which Solomon had, even the cities for his chariots and his horsemen, and all that it pleased Solomon to build in Jerusalem. All that delighted Solomon was these things, was building these cities, was fortifying them, was spreading out his military to build in Jerusalem and in Lebanon and in all the land under his rule. The question is, what should have it been Solomon's delight to do? What should have pleased Solomon to do? Build fortified cities? To walk in his ways, the statutes and commandments that I have given you. It was really, really clear. So that makes the convicting question not as fun. What should you and I be pleased to do? What should we delight to do? To walk in his ways, the statutes and commandments I have given you. And yet, what do we delight in? What pleases us? If I said, you have an hour to do whatever you want. Money is no object. What are you going to do next weekend? What would you choose? What was Solomon's delight? It was to build and fortify these cities and monuments. 1 Kings 9, verse 20 and 21 reminds us of the danger of not obeying God in the long term. Okay? All the people who were left of all the peoples there, their descendants who were left after them, whom the sons of Israel were unable to destroy. Why are all these people in the land of Israel? Well, it goes back quite a ways. I want to really briefly run you through a history of this problem, okay? Numbers 33:52, God says, you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you and destroy all their figured stones, destroy all their molten images, and demolish all their high places. This is amazing. This is what God tells them before they ever get to the land. Verse 55, Numbers 33:55. If you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, it shall come about that those whom you let remain of them will become as pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and they will trouble you in the land in which you live. That's prophetic, isn't it? It all began in Joshua chapter 9. You remember when the Hivites, the Gibeonites, came, and they pretended to be from faraway country, and so Joshua foolishly made a covenant with them without inquiring of the Lord. And so instead of being able to kill them because he made a covenant, it says in Joshua 9:27, Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water. So the Hivites, the Gibeonites, were made forced labor even at the time of Joshua. But it gets even worse. Joshua 16:10, they did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer, all the way until Pharaoh dealt with it in the time of Solomon. Judges 1:21, the sons of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem, so the Jebusites lived with the sons of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. You're like, well, come on, Benjamin, why don't you guys do your job? Well, Judges 1:27 says, Manasseh did not take possession of Beth Shin and its villages, or Tanakh and its villages, and so on and so forth, so the Canaanites persisted in living in that land. Okay, two tribes. Judges 1:28. Came about when Israel became strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor. They did not drive them out completely. 1:29, Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites who were living in Gezer, so the Canaanites lived in Gezer among them. Judges 3:5-7. The sons of Israel lived, listen to this, among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. They took their daughters for themselves as wives, gave their own daughters to their sons, and served their gods. The sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals. Sin has consequences. From the time of Joshua, this was a problem in their land. God told them to drive them out, to remove every instance of false gods, and they didn't. And here, years later, now Solomon is authoritatively forcing laborers of the people of the nation to build these monuments for himself, and ultimately we're going to find it drives a wedge in the nation, and then because of Solomon's sin, God's judgment on it, the nation's going to split under his son. Foolishness for years and years and years to not drive out what God had said to them. You'll notice that Solomon is smart enough to not make native Israelites do his forced labor for him. Verse 22, Solomon did not make slaves of the sons of Israel. Rather, he conscripted them into other things, men of war, his servants, princes, captains, so on. Why? Well, because that was directly against the law. Leviticus 25:39, if a countryman of yours becomes so poor that he sells himself, you shall not subject him to a slave's service. He wasn't allowed to do that. Verse 23 tells us that there were 550 of his chief officers ruling over the people doing his work. I think it's interesting that it says Solomon's work, Solomon's business, or his mission in life, if you will. He has these 550 overseeing it. If you compare it with 2 Chronicles, it seems like the numbers are off, but they actually add up to the same number. So Chronicles separates it into 3,600 foremen and 250 chief officers, whereas Kings separates it 3,300 foremen and 550 officers. So apparently 300 of them were in some kind of a separate class that could be counted either way. 1 Kings 9:24 tells us when he built the Millo. It says, as soon as Pharaoh's daughter came up from the city of David to her house, which Solomon had built for her, then he built the Millo. So there was a project he wanted to do in Jerusalem, building the Millo, and he couldn't because, well, his wife is living in a house where he needs to be building. And just so you know, demolishing your wife's house without having a new house is a bad idea. Solomon knows this because he is the wisest man on earth. And so he chooses to build his wife a new house, to move her, and then to start his construction project. So the question is, what is a millo? The answer is, we really don't know. But we think, because of what it says here, that it is this terrace structure on the side of Jerusalem. So this whole thing is on a hill. When David conquered the city of Jerusalem under the Jebusites, it was just this little pink area, which is called the city of David, okay? When Solomon came, he extended it up through the Orange. He built the temple and the altar and the palace complex there. Apparently, he moved his wife into the palace complex, and then he restructured and fortified this whole section on the side of the hill into these massive terraces so that it fortified the side and gave defense against anyone who had attacked from the southeast. That would be the Millo, as best we can tell, okay? So Solomon moves his wife, and he finishes his project there, finishing Jerusalem. So the question for you and me in this context is, what kind of accomplishments are we after? What are we delighting in and thinking that we can find security for our future in if we can just do this thing? If we can just fortify the cities around, if we can just establish storage cities, if we can just fortify the defenses of our own city, what is that in your life? What are you looking to accomplish so that you'll know that the rest of your future is secure? Solomon was after the security of accomplishments, it would seem. Number three, I've got a long way to go here. Number three, it appears that Solomon is seeking security in religion. Verse 25, now three times in a year, Solomon offered burnt offerings and peace offerings on the altar, which he built to the Lord, burning incense with him on the altar, which was before the Lord, and so he finished the house. Now, 2 Chronicles 8, the parallel passage, goes into a lot more detail. It talks about how he established these offerings because of the three feasts which were commanded in Exodus and Deuteronomy, celebrating the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Weeks, the Feast of Booths. It also says that he obeyed his father David. He established the divisions of the priests and their duties for ministering. It says that he established the gatekeepers and so on. It says he did not depart from the commandment of the king to the priests and Levites in any manner. Thus, all the work of Solomon was carried out from the day of the foundation of the house of the Lord and until it was finished. So when it says here he finished the house, it doesn't mean he finished construction on the house. It means he finished establishing the proper procedures for the whole management of the temple. But what I think is interesting is back in 1 Kings chapter 9, even though Solomon did everything that he was supposed to do, the author of 1 Kings 9 just spent 10 verses telling us how he built storage cities and chariot cities and fortifying Jerusalem, and he spends one short verse saying that Solomon set up the temple how it was supposed to be done. It makes me feel, and I can't prove this to you, that there was a lack of emphasis in Solomon's life at this point on the worship. You see chapter 8? 60 verses of prayer and dedication and blessing the people and sacrificing so much that they couldn't keep up with how much they were sacrificing. And then here, Solomon did exactly what was prescribed. Just that. It seems, and we'll see this foreshadowing come to bear in the next several chapters, that Solomon never really stopped worshiping, never stopped his religion, but it sure did, his heart did change. So the question for you and me is, this is a scary thought, but are you practicing the religion without your heart being engaged in walking in God's ways? Are you doing just enough so that it looks like you are doing exactly what you ought to be, but your heart is not engaged in worshiping God and sacrificing for him? The last attempt at security in Solomon's life, and we can pursue this as well, is the security of wealth. Verses 26 to 28 says, King Solomon also built a fleet of ships in Ezion-Geber, which is near Eloth on the shore of the Red Sea in the land of Edom. Hiram sent his servants with the fleet, sailors who knew the sea, along with the servants of Solomon. They went to Ophir, took 420 talents of gold from there, and brought it to King Solomon. So, pretty picture for you of the port of Ezion-Geber near Eloth. The southern tip of Israel, where the Red Sea comes up and touches the land of Edom, Solomon's kingdom, different than anyone before him and after, extended all the way to the Red Sea, and therefore he actually had the opportunity to build ships because he owned a port city, okay, on the Red Sea there. So it's different because you'll know if you have geography in your head, the Mediterranean Sea, trying to get to anywhere in the east is pretty much impossible, okay? You have to go all the way around Africa. Whereas if you start in the Red Sea, you go right through Arabia and you're in the Indian Ocean, okay? So Solomon builds a port city, and it says ships, a whole fleet of ships in this port city. Now, the problem is that if you ever think of an Israelite, don't think of a seafaring person because they don't do that. And so they built ships, and then they hired Phoenicians from Tyre, King Hiram's kingdom, to come and sail them. This is just an aside, but I think it's funny. The word sailors here, it's literally just the two words shipmen, okay? These guys, they do ships. We don't know what they do, but they do ships. So we got them, and we put them on our ships in Ezion-Geber. Verse 28, why? Why would he build ships? Why would he build a fleet in the Red Sea? Well, it's because they wanted to go, verse 28, to Ophir. What is Ophir? Well, we don't know exactly. It's a city somewhere, a land somewhere. Job 28, when Job is describing the value of wisdom, he says, wisdom cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir. Whatever this place is, it is synonymous with the value of pure gold. So the question is, where is Ophir? We would like to go there, right? Solomon wanted to go there too. Well, we don't know exactly. The three regions that are most likely that have been given is either the coast of Arabia or Africa, there at the bottom of the Red Sea, the coast of India or Pakistan, or all the way to the Americas, okay? That last one is a very minority view and probably not likely. So the question is, it's either Arabia, Africa, or India. We're not sure. We know in other places that Solomon eventually imported things like peacocks and apes and all these other spices and so on. Both of those things, Mozambique on the southeastern shore of Africa could be that. Those things can be imported from India. We're not exactly sure. So one of those places, and they went there. Why did they go there? Well, they went there to bring back 420 talents of gold. In today's money, that would be near $1 billion. Okay, so Solomon, desiring to continue to establish and solidify his rule and the greatest kingdom on earth, says we need to have commerce and wealth. So he builds ships so that they can travel down the coast and they can bring back, as they trade and so on, these precious jewels and a whole lot of gold. Are you tempted to idolize wealth? Your career success? Tempted to think that if you have enough money in the bank or enough retirement that you can be secure in your future? It's easy to do. And yet, we are not called to find our security for the future in bank accounts, are we? Called to find our security in God. So as we look back at these things in the second half of chapter 9, when he gives cities to Hiram, and when he builds all these cities and the storage cities, and he establishes the worship in the temple, and he builds ships to go for commerce, are those things really wrong? Were they wrong for Solomon to do? And we have to be honest to say, not necessarily. These things are good things for a leader in a country to do. Dale Ralph Davis finishes by saying this. He says, these activities, on the whole, they're legitimate concerns of kings. They're simply what kings do. Perhaps they seem a bit secular to us, but that's the case with all of our daily work. We find ourselves doing whatever electricians or paralegals or accountants or welders or real estate agents do, right? A lot of our lives are spent doing normal, regular things. Maybe Solomon is just doing what he's supposed to do as a king. Davis says, and yet we must not forget that the previous verses, verses 6 through 9, stand like a Mount Rushmore peering down over the second half of the chapter. One may be enjoying a thoroughly successful kingly or ministerial career and yet end in utter ruin unless one takes obedience to the first commandment as his highest calling. You see that? You see, 1 Kings chapter 9 should have been really short. It should have been the first 9 verses, and there should have been one more that says Solomon understood the warning from God, and therefore he lived and walked in God's ways for the rest of his life, and everything else was superfluous. But it didn't. It doesn't. It says that Solomon, in response to God's warning, did all these other things trying to establish and solidify his rule. So the question for you and me is, are we going to take the first thing, God's secure offer of a future if we obey, or are we going to take the second and potentially lose everything, definitely lose everything by disobeying God? We have the same offer to us. John 12:26, Jesus says, if anyone serves me, he must follow me. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. But John 3:36, Jesus says, he who believes in the Son has eternal life. He who does not obey the Son will not see life, but the wrath of God abides on him. The offer that God made to Solomon is the same offer you and I have. If we disobey, there is nothing for us but destruction and wrath. John 14:1-3. Do not let your heart be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you, for I go to prepare a place for you. If I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. You understand that there is no more secure future than being wherever Jesus is. And Jesus promises that those who are his people, if we love him, we will keep his commandments. We will walk in obedience. And for those people, he is coming again. He will receive us, and we will never leave his side again. That's a secure future we need. Not fortified cities and gifts to Phoenicians. You understand? We want the secure future of obedience to God and eternity with Christ. Let's pray. God, thank you for your grace and love. Thank you for your kindness to us. Thank you for the clear picture that we have in this passage of the call you have given to us to obey you and to find security in that for our future. God, we pray that we would respond rightly, that we would trust in you and obey you for the rest of our days. God, I also pray for the time of fellowship we're about to have. I pray for the food that we're going to enjoy. And I pray that you would bless our time, that it would be a wonderful time of refreshment and encouragement to us, and ultimately that it would honor you in your great name. I pray all this in your name. Amen.